Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Myron Magnet, who was the longtime editor of City Journal and is now the editor at large at that distinguished quarterly, which I told him in advance was important to me. Pieces that appeared there helped shape my shift, actually, from left to right in the late 90s, early aughts. He is the author of many things, including The Founders at Home, The Building of America, 1735 to 1817. Today, he's here to discuss a new book entitled Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution, out from Encounter Books this year. Welcome, Editor Magnet.
Such a pleasure to be with you, sir.
Let's just begin with the title there. What is the Lost Constitution?
Well, you know, I'm a journalist, so when I want to know something, I write a book about it. And if that's the way you do the research. And I wanted to know what kind of republic the Founding Fathers wanted to create and what kind of government they aimed to frame. And that's why I wrote The Founders at Home. Beautiful, beautiful thing. But then that raised a whole set of other questions, which is, we don't have that government anymore. So how did we lose it, and how do we get it back? And that's how I got to Clarence Thomas, because in 28 years now of opinions on the courts, he has laid forth a kind of comprehensive history of constitutional subversion and set forth a roadmap for constitutional restoration that I think the court is now getting ready to follow.
I would recommend to everyone this book. It's not long. It's very readable. I think it's a great introduction to the significance of Clarence Thomas, which has been certainly downplayed over the decades. I mean, when you just said 28 years, I'm thinking, wow, he's been on the court a long time.
Longest serving justice now.
And you don't hear very much about his ideas, about his opinions. There was an exhibit, an African-American history exhibit in D.C.
It was
a couple of years ago.
It was the Museum of African-American History that left him out.
It left him out, but it put Anita Hill in.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah, but there was such a stink about it.
Right, initially.
That finally they corrected their mistake. Now, you know, my view is that Clarence Thomas, 100 years from now, will be looked at as the most consequential jurist of his era. And let me... You know, let me tell you why I think it. Scalia, he was always, you know, Clarence Thomas was always thought to be Justice Scalia's ventriloquist dummy. Right?
It was remarkable.
Yeah.
The way one would hear, he's just a stooge for Scalia.
Justice.
Yes.
And Scalia said, you know what, when it comes to originalism, I am a faint-hearted originalist. Clarence Thomas is the real thing. He's a real originalist. So what is that original constitution that Clarence Thomas is preserving, protecting, and defending? And so it's what the framers wrote in 1787, improved by the Bill of Rights a couple of years later, then perfected by the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War and the 19th Amendment that gave women the vote.
13th, 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments are the perfection.
The perfection. And so what Thomas would say is that there is no, you know, to the objection that so many people give to originalism, which is, how can a document that's 232 years old have any relevance to our modern conditions? The answer is, there has never been so up-to-date or even avant-garde an idea of government than not a government that rules you, but a government whose only function is to protect your right to pursue your own happiness in your own way, in your family and your individual community. Never, never, never has there been anything this modern. And then Clarence Thomas traces the three stages, in his view, by which the original Constitution got subverted.
This is an important part of your book, laying out the three climactic moments when we lost, we started to lose the Constitution.
And you know, I learned about the first one from Justice Thomas, because I didn't know this until I started, especially the finest of his opinions, McDonald v. Chicago. It's about keeping guns in your house. But I mean, it expands and expands and expands beyond that. And he gave me a sort of short history of Reconstruction, and which sent me off to do a full court press on it. But he says, okay, essentially, here's the story. We can go back a little further. You know that Clarence Thomas is a Straussian, and he was taught his Straussianism by two Claremont guys who worked for him when he ran the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission.
They were students of Harry Jaffe,
Of Harry Jaffe, yeah. So it was Ken Masugi and John Marini.
Who's written, Ken Masugi, who's written for us,
And Marini has a new book out, and it was Ken who told me, that Thomas said to him, hey, I don't have time to think about these things here. I got a huge agency to run that's a mess. You think about them. So they gave him a graduate course in Straussianism. And basically, the idea is that the founders knew perfectly well that slavery was inconsistent with their principles. Mr. Jefferson knew when writing the Declaration of Independence that the slavery that supported the life he lived was unjust. But they could not abolish it if they hoped to get the Constitution ratified. So they did, and now, this is Abraham Lincoln speaking. If you read his speeches, as Harry Jaffa and Leo Strauss will tell you, read his speeches, and from 1854 onward, from the Peoria speech onward, he's just on and on about this. They knew it was unjust, so what did they do? They tried to prevent its spread by banning it in the Northwest Territories. They banned the slave trade after 1808. They figured that by limiting it in these ways, it would just die out of its own economic unworkability, because the tobacco lands were getting exhausted after all. Mm. They did not foresee the cotton gin. Didn't foresee that slavery would move and expand down into the deep South. Okay, so they got this. They got it. But the whole history of the Republic from 1820 till the Civil War is an attempt to compromise all this. We couldn't compromise it. Fought a terrible Civil War. Nearly 400,000 Union troops died to make men free. We passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, and the heart of that is the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, which aimed, this is Justice Thomas speaking, to clothe freed slaves in all the rights guaranteed by the Bill of Rights against any depredations by the state governments. Hmm. Along comes his own Supreme Court, this is a matter of deep shame to him, and in two 1870s decisions, one in 73, one in 76, say, hang on. And by the way, the whole country is sitting on the edge of its chair waiting to know how is the court gonna interpret these amendments. And the court says, oh, no, don't think that the 14th Amendment gives all the rights of the Bill of Rights to freed slaves. It's rights like being protected by the government on international waterways, or the right not to be subject to bills of attainder, they say in 73. In 76, they say, anyway, the Constitution doesn't confer these rights.
And this was simply Southern politics?
We don't even know, because a whole bunch of the guys in the majority were Lincoln appointees, right? I don't know. I've read the opinions. I've read the dissents. And if you read the dissents, I mean, particularly the dissent in Cruikshank in 76, there were three dissenters, and they were furious. I mean, they said, wait, we know what the 14th Amendment's Privileges and Immunities Clause was about. What are you guys talking about? But nevertheless, that happened. And so for 90 plus years, you had the reign of Jim Crow in the South. Mm. And Clarence Thomas says, this is personal to me.
You know, this case
Yeah.
is not nearly as well known as
Roe v. Wade or Dred Scott or Plessy v. Ferguson.
Right.
No, but
this one is
Slaughterhouse and Cruikshank, and it's out of these cases
more significant than Plessy.
Yeah, more significant.
More of an impact.
You wouldn't get
Plessy without them.
Yes, correct. But we can talk about the impact of these things because they, I mean, they're still reverberating to this very moment, Mark. Mm-hmm. I mean, these cases.
And this is one reason why you identify one of the dangers of having lost the Constitution is, quote, the imperial Supreme Court.
You
call it imperial.
You betcha. Yes. And so Clarence Thomas says, I know about government oppression, right?
Actually, let me interrupt. Another good phrase by you is, the Supreme Court has become a, quote, permanent constitutional convention.
Okay, that gets us to the second.
It's a good line.
That gets us to the second of the subversions, the second act of the subversion, which involves, as a theorist, Woodrow Wilson, and as the guy who supersized it, in fact, Franklin Roosevelt. And Wilson hated the founders, and was very explicit about it. Read Wilson's works, he hated them. He says, we live in the modern age. We live in a Darwinian age where everything is changing fast. We need a government that can adapt, wham, bam, bam, just like that. And these guys have got this limited machinery that moves slow, and we need a government that can adapt in a Darwinian fashion. They've given us something Newtonian. They're antiques belonging to another era. So, yeah, we need a Supreme Court that makes up law as it goes along, and we need an army of bureaucrats in independent or executive branch agencies like the FTC or the SEC that make rules like a legislature, that carry them out like an executive, and that adjudicate and punish infractions of them like a judiciary.
You know, Myron, you give a modern version of that when you quote Senator Dianne Feinstein. This length going on and on about how the experts really need to take care of everything. What was that?
That was in the Gorsuch hearings.
The Gorsuch hearings, right.
And she's explaining why we have Chevron deference, right? Which is, you know, remember, it's the Supreme Court that validated all these usurpations of power, right? In the New Deal, when Franklin Roosevelt wanted to grab hold of the whole economy because he wrongly believed that the Depression was a crisis of overproduction, right? So he wanted to limit output. The Supreme Court was saying, no, you can't do it. And that's when Franklin Roosevelt said, all right, I'm going to enlarge the court and pack it with New Dealers. And a justice named Owen Roberts in this case, said, I give up, right? And they let him take control. They let him take control of the whole economy. But here's the thing. Woodrow Wilson, the theorist, taught himself German to read Hegel and Hegel's followers, right? And what was the model of Hegel's philosophy? It was the Rechtsstaat, right? And their hero was Frederick the Great, King of Prussia, who was, to be sure, an enlightened despot and had this incorruptible and non-political civil service. But they, you know, Woodrow Wilson and the progressives, capital P, really believed it represented progress to replace democratic self-government with enlightened despotism. And had they not read their history to know that enlightenment always evaporates, leaving behind only the despotism?
But Myron, we'll do it right this time.
Oh, we'll do it right.
And because we get the right people in there, and we'll do it right.
Mark, you read in the paper just a couple of months ago, right? I mean, this is, it's like, you know, every day the newspaper delivers examples of. So here's a rancher in Montana. There's been a lot of fires recently, forest fires. So he's worried about it. He's got a little trickle on his mountain acres, and he says, I'm going to dig a couple of ponds. So in case, God forbid, my woods catch fire, I got a reservoir to pump out of. EPA comes along, says, excuse me, you have violated a rule here. And you have, by doing so, polluted the navigable waterways of the United States. And we are fining you $130,000 and putting you in prison for 18 months. All right? They proceed to do this. Now, this is just plain tyranny. It's a rule. The Congress made a law of the navigable waterways.
Do you really think this rancher doesn't know what he's doing?
I mean, that's what the EPA thought. These are, you know, so Dianne Feinstein is saying there are these experts, and the experts come along and say, we know better than the rancher who's actually trying to stop the damn woods from burning down.
And one of the remarkable things about Feinstein's statement, which does go on and on, you quote a long, long paragraphs, which I think is important, because she also makes the claim in there that this is the American tradition. She gives a kind of historical authority going back to the beginning this approach.
To Wilson.
Well, that is the beginning.
To Wilson.
What the real American...
That's where progress began, right? Progress began in the 19-teens under Wilson.
Now, you see Clarence Thomas as one of the monumental and will be historic figures standing athwart these tides and saying, stop.
Yes.
You talk about his upbringing. Would you find certain experiences, youthful experiences, went into this conviction makes him stand up?
That's a wonderful question. It gets to one of the central themes in my book. Yes, he has a remarkable life history. He didn't exactly go from a log cabin to the White House, but he went from a kerosene-lit Georgia shanty to the high bench. Pretty terrific. So when he was seven, his mother, now divorced, took him and his little brother to live in a Savannah slum. And after a year of, he says, cold that he couldn't get warm, hunger that he couldn't assuage, his mother realized she couldn't keep the kids, gave them to her father and stepmother, who lived a few blocks away. Now, her father was an extraordinary man, self-made man, who had started a little coal and ice business that became a fuel oil delivery business. So he was a real American entrepreneur, very small way, semi-literate, right? But he was determined that he was going to raise these two boys to grow up to have coat and tie jobs, as he put it. So thing one, in his own self-making, he had become a Catholic. He wanted an orderly religion. And he sent the kids, you know, this was a big item on the budget. He sent the kids to Catholic school, segregated, right, like everything in Savannah. But the Irish nuns who taught there, mostly immigrants, taught that all men are created equal and therefore segregation was wrong, right? So he learned as a kid, right, Mr. Jefferson's fundamental American principle, right? All men are created equal and endowed with unalienable rights. Very, very important.
Does he credit those nuns with
a
lot?
Oh, does he ever? Yeah. Does he? There's a beautiful picture of one of the nuns, you know, coming to see him when he's on the Supreme Court, and this little old nun is just throwing her arms around, you know. I mean, it's just moving beyond belief. Yes, he credits them.
And people should know that Savannah, which I've spent some time in Savannah, this is not the Savannah of, you know, the antebellum homes.
Oh.
This is the Savannah of, you know, before SCAD. Savannah College of Art and Design transformed this. Savannah was deeply poor, port.
And the block next to where he grew up, his grandfather called the Blood Bucket and forbade the boys to go there. But Thomas remembers stepping over drunks, you know, on the street. I mean, yeah, he describes how bad it was. And by the way, in 1960, the KKK held its convention in Savannah and marched in their witches' costumes down Main Street, Savannah, in their pointy hats. So, Clarence Thomas was too scared to go and see it, but he knew it was happening there. Okay.
This certainly gives quite a comment on the liberals who accuse Clarence Thomas of not understanding racism, not seeing the operations of race.
This is so painful to him. You know, when he got named to the court, you know, so Justice Leon Higginbotham, the senior black judge after Thurgood Marshall, wrote an open letter to Clarence Thomas in a law journal saying, you're just an affirmative action appointee. The senators who voted for you were just doing it for political reasons. They wouldn't even have hired you as your lawyer, right?
You quote sections of it. The condescension and disrespect are extraordinary. Yeah. This is the first African American on the court.
No, second.
Of course.
So Thurgood Marshall got it, by the way. I mean, Clarence Thomas went to call on him when he arrived at the court and thought it would be a 10-minute courtesy call. They sat for hours. And Marshall said, look, I did in my time what I had to do. You do in your time what you have to do. But Thomas went, when he was running EEOC, to the National Lawyers Association, the biggest, oldest group of, organization of black lawyers and judges.
Just quick, Thomas went into Reagan's administration in the early years, first in the Education Department, correct?
Correct, in the Civil Rights Division of the Education Department.
And then he goes over to run EEOC.
Really cleans it up, right? And stops making it a statistical-based affirmative action machine, mm-hmm. right? He says the law deals with individuals. Right, it doesn't deal with statistics. So if somebody has had an individual harm done, we will address that individual harm. A big deal.
Did this directive, do you think, come from Reagan,
no.
or was much of this Thomas's
no.
initiative?
This is Thomas, and Thomas had come, you know. So there he is at the EEOC, and he's by now. Let me go back, Mark, because you know, we got to get to how he got to where he was. So there he is delivering oil as a kid with his grandfather after school and on weekends, never a minute free, homework, delivering oil, Catholic school, right? In summers, the two boys went with their grandfather to 60 acres down in South Georgia, opposite where their ancestors had been enslaved, right? And with their grandfather, they built a cinder block house, they cleared the land, they tilled it. Every summer they would farm it, harvest the crops, butcher the animals, put the stuff in the freezer. He grew up as like a pioneer, basically, right? He learned self-reliance by being self-reliant. And his grandfather was continually showering them with the stuff that I'm sure your mother told you, just as my mother told me, right? Where there's a will, there's a way. Then Thomas had promised his grandfather he was going to be Savannah's first black priest. He goes to a seminary where he's one of the very few black guys. Martin Luther King gets shot. A fellow seminarian says, I hope the son of a bitch dies. And that was the end of Thomas's vocation. He said, a man studying to be a priest wished this fate on a man of God. He said he was already upset about the church's stance on segregation, and so that was it. So he goes to Holy Cross and becomes a black radical, you know, for a while. And the whole
protested the war.
Oh man, but protested American racism, right? America with three K's. At the end of his junior year, he says, you know, we really, you know, acted out being angry. So he goes to a demonstration to free America's black political prisoners. This is Black Panther murderers, right? In Harvard Square. And it turns into a riot. And a friend of ours was there and said, hey, I saw it. And, you know, it was just as violent as Justice Thomas says it was. You know, property damaged and burned, policemen beat up and injured, you know, just a real riot. And so he arrived back at Holy Cross in the morning and went into the chapel and prayed to God to take away this anger, which he said was going to ruin his life. Hmm. And he said he asked himself at this point, do I really believe in the American promise, as Mr. Jefferson put it, right? And he said, yeah, I really do. yeah, I really do. And so then he came to realize that everything that black radicalism was asking for was not helpful. He came to see in Holy Cross where affirmative action was just getting underway, and then in Yale Law, where affirmative action was really the order of the day, that it was doing harm to kids who were in over their head and who would have succeeded if they were in the right school, but were a notch or two above them, so they were failing, they were growing resentful and angry and not getting their degrees. And the successful guys like him were tarred with the affirmative action brush, so it was assumed that he was, you know, he wasn't qualified, just as Judge Higginbotham had said. So he said after Yale Law School, he couldn't get a job. He couldn't get a real job. He ended up going to work for Attorney General Danforth in Missouri. And that's how he got to Washington. When Danforth became a senator, he went to Washington with Danforth, but so and then joined the Reagan administration. And he's watching what happens to the supposed beneficiaries of affirmative action. He thinks, no. This is not working. It is not doing any good to the black supposed beneficiaries, and it's not doing any good to the society, because there's this imputation of inferiority, so that, you know, blacks feel both inferior and resentful, and whites feel contempt, mm-hmm. And anger if they're, you know, if they're crowded out, you know, from academe, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when suddenly you had to be a woman or a black, or preferably a black woman, if you were gonna get a tenure track job in academe. So he said, so he got that this was not the way to go. And he got that what his grandfather had been telling him all these years, even though his grandfather was a lifelong Democrat, a very active member of the NAACP, that was conservatism. Mm-hmm. And that leads to the answer to your question, you know, what about Justice Thomas's own history? His own history convinced him, and he says this in speech after speech, that it takes a certain kind of individual and national character to be capable of liberty. You can't have a free republic without free citizens. And that means that you need people who are willing to take responsibility for their own fate and for their own failures, not people who say, hey, I'm a victim of larger forces beyond me, and I need a giant government to protect me against these forces. He says, when I was a kid, you know, you're younger than I am, but you probably remember this. Did you read landmark biographies growing up?
I remember some of those.
Yeah, I mean, I devoured them, and he did too. And he said, you know, so we would read these biographies of George Washington and Marie Curie and George Washington Carver. And the whole idea was we admired heroes, people who overcame circumstance, who overcame adversity.
I needed heroes when I was 14.
Man, you needed role models, you know? How do you make yourself, right? An adolescent is all about making a self, right? And he said, so those used to be our role models, and the idea was you could make your own fate. And not only that, you could actually change the fate of your country and the world. So that was a very important example. He said, now all we talk about is victims.
Right.
You know, and if we're going to turn out,
and we talk about those victims in sort of impersonal ways. We don't even get personal about them because it's circumstantial, social forces.
Billiard balls, right? Yeah, yeah. Right? They're just pushed around by something that hits them from outside.
Yeah.
And you cannot have a free republic without free citizens, and you can't have free citizens unless you have a culture that nurtures that kind of character. And so here we go back to the campus, you know, and right to your bailiwick and to Heather McDonald's bailiwick. If you've got a culture which is always saying, oh, we need these safe spaces to get away from the pervasive racism and sexism and what have you, and everybody is a victim or has to be ashamed of his own American heritage, You can't have a free republic. And I think this is where we're at right now. And, you know, Thomas says, there's a wonderful speech in which he says, we think everything is done with the laws. He says, that's wrong. It isn't. It isn't. It's done in here, he says, pointing to his heart, right? It's what you believe in here that counts. Because finally, culture is the determinant of history, right? People's beliefs are the determinant of history. And if you believe you are a free man in an opportunity society, you will go ahead and forge your fate as the founding fathers and the Constitution of Liberty intended for you to do. And if you believe you're a victim, you're just gonna, you know, I mean, after all, empires rise and fall, and they fall because of decadence, and decadence has to do with the dissolution of the national character. And what Clarence Thomas is very, very concerned about is making sure that we keep intact not just the Constitution of Liberty, but the culture of liberty.
Editor Myron Magnet, the book is Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution, out with Encounter Books. Thank you.
Such a pleasure, Mark.